We were for so long a despised and persecuted sect. We were for so long deprived of any opportunity to explain our position, that Englishmen have come to look upon us as a race of ogres, from whom nothing natural, nothing human can be expected. They will believe anything of us, without stopping to inquire whether such beliefs are even plausible. Among half a dozen instances of this credulity, let me select one that is peculiarly striking, and peculiarly well attested. At the beginning of the First World War, when it was suggested to the government that Catholics, like their neighbors, would need an increased staff of chaplains to superintend their spiritual welfare, a cabinet minister professed himself astonished that the ministrations of French priests would not be sufficient. And when it was pointed out to him that these priests would find some difficulty in hearing confessions, it proved that the cabinet minister had assumed, all his life, that Catholics made their confessions in Latin. One pictures those Irish troops, a Kennedy in every knapsack. So true is it that the English sense of realities breaks down when the habits of Catholics are in question. By an equally grotesque illusion, most Englishmen have the idea that Catholics base all their religious beliefs on the authority of the Church. And if we press them with the difficulty, yes, but on what do Catholics base their belief in the authority of the Church? Do they base that on the authority of the Church too? I suspect that most Englishmen would reply, of course, these people are Catholics, therefore any reason or no reason is good enough for them. They are a race apart, ogres, not men. Let me then, to avoid further ambiguity, give a list of certain leading doctrines which no Catholic, upon a moment's reflection, could accept on the authority of the Church, and on that ground alone. I, the existence of God. II, the fact that he has made a revelation to the world in Jesus Christ. III, the life in its broad outlines, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. IV, the fact that our Lord founded a church. V, the fact that he bequeathed to that church his own teaching office, with the guarantee naturally, that it should not err in teaching. V, the consequent intellectual duty of believing what the Church believes. I do not say that these considerations are present to the mind of every Catholic, however ignorant, however stupid. I do say that these are the considerations which any Catholic teacher would put before him, if and in so far as he showed any curiosity about the matter. I would add that a glance at the Penny Catechism will disabuse any unbiased mind of the idea that the Church, even in dealing with simple folk, conceals from them the intellectual basis of their religion. Yet the average Protestant persists in believing that the attitude of the Church towards the human intellect is adequately summed up in the phrase, familiar to us from childhood, open your mouth and shut your eyes. It is supposed that anybody is brought up as a Catholic retains, without any further questioning or instruction on the point, the pious credulity with which he accepted all that his mother told him, all that the priest told him, when he was too young to think for himself. Any dawning doubts as to the sufficiency of such a motive for belief are crushed, we must suppose, with threats of hell and excommunication. This would be extraordinary enough, considering the number of Catholics there are in the world and the ample opportunities they have for being infected, in a world like ours, with the germs of unbelief. But, still more extraordinary, this Church, which has no proof of anything she says beyond her own bare assertion, is making converts, in an enlightened country like ours, at the rate of some 12,000 in the year. How does she manage, one wonders, to play off her confidence trick with such repeated success? This is, indeed, a phenomenon that which non-Catholics profess to feel the utmost astonishment. But it is a kind of astonishment which has grown blunted by usage. They have come to regard it as part of the order of things, that their neighbors should become the victims, now and again, of this extraordinary tour de force. If they were compelled to picture to themselves the process of a conversion, they would, I suppose, conceive it something after this fashion, that the mind of the inquirer is hypnotized into acquiescence by the crafty blandishments of a designing priest, not by his arguments, for he has none. He only goes on shouting, become a Catholic, or you'll go to hell, not by his arguments, but by some fatal quality of fascination, which we breed, no doubt, in the seminaries. In a dazed condition, like that of the bird under the snake's eye, he assents to every formula presented to him, binds himself by every oath that is proposed to him, in one or Benmouth act of unreasoning surrender. After that, of course, pride forbids him to admit, so long as life lasts, that the choice so made was a mistaken one. Besides, one knows the power these priests have. Yes, it is very curious, the power attributed to these priests. When you have had the privilege of assisting at their education for 7 years, you feel that curious is too weak a word for it. This is, presumably, what Protestants have in mind when they represent submission to the Church as a form of intellectual suicide. They mean that the act of faith which a man makes in joining the Church is an act of the will, or, more properly speaking, the emotions, in which the intellect plays no part. It is an entertaining fact, familiar to all are acquainted with the history of Protestantism, that one of the earliest and one of the fiercest controversies between the Reformation and the old religion was concerned precisely with this point. It was, of course, the Protestants maintained the view that faith was an act of the will, or, more properly speaking, the emotions, with frequent allusion to the misunderstood text, "With the heart man believeth unto salvation," whereas their Catholic opponents earned bitter hatred by insisting that the act of faith, however much directed by the will, had its seat in the intellect. Historically, Protestantism is committed to the notion that the act of faith is the mere surrender of a personality to a personality, without parley, without deliberation, without logical motive. The true representative of Protestantism in the modern world is the Salvationist stands up at a street corner and cries out, "I'm saved." It is Catholicism which insists that, ideally at least, it is the intellect which must be satisfied first, the heart afterwards. Nor, in point of fact, has modern Protestantism any right to tax us with exalting faith at the expense of reason. It was only the other day that I read an able defense of theism by an Anglican philosopher, appeared to demand faith of some kind as a preliminary to accepting the doctrine of God's existence. No Catholic apologist ever fell into so grotesque an error. We demand, indeed, on the part of the inquirer certain negative dispositions, as an absence of prejudice and of frivolity, a willingness to listen and to attend, determination in carrying an argument to its logical conclusion, etc. But to demand of the inquirer any positive will to believe as the condition of accepting the existence of God is to beg the whole question, to stultify the whole process of philosophical discussion. Nobody will take the trouble to look at any manual of Catholic apologetics, will fail to understand that several of the questions most controverted today do not fall, from the Catholic point of view, under the object of faith. At least primarily, they are matters upon which we have to make up our minds beforehand, logically speaking, as a condition of making any act of faith at all. And when I say, make up our minds, I mean, not a mere decision of the will, but a satisfaction of the intellect. The existence of God, the authority of Christ, and so on, are beliefs which meet us, and have to be dealt with, before we get onto the act of faith at all. They are the preambles of faith, the motives of credibility, and we have to deal with them by a reasoning process, which throws the responsibility for our decision not upon the authority of the Church, but upon our own private judgment. Every convert, when he goes under instruction, has to follow these arguments to the best of his ability. Nor is it only for the sake of converts that we insist upon this intellectual duty. A class in apologetics is part of the normal curriculum of a Catholic school. Catholic boys are learning to defend the existence of God at an age when you and I, reader, were dismally memorizing facts about the career of Jehoshaphat and gnashing our teeth on the self-collation theory. When you have contrived to persuade him that, for Catholics, the authority of the Church in matters of faith is not a self-evident axiom, but a truth arrived at by a process of argument, the Protestant controversialist has his retort ready. You admit, then, after all, he says, that a man has to use his own private judgment in order to arrive at religious truth. Why, then, what is the use of authority in religion at all? I had always supposed that there was a straight issue between us, you supporting authority and I private judgment. I had always supposed that you criticized me for my presumption in searching for God by the light of my imperfect human reason. It proves now that you are no less guilty of such presumption than myself. Surely your approaches are inconsistent, and your distinctions unnecessary. If you use your private judgment to establish certain cardinal points of theology, the existence of God, the authority of Christ, and so on, why may not I use my private judgment to establish not only these, but all other points of theology? Questions such as the doctrine of the Blessed Trinity, or the real presence in the Eucharist. You can hardly blame me for using the very privileges which you have just claimed so eagerly for yourself. I could not have imagined, if I had not heard it with my own ears, the accent of surprise with which Protestants suddenly light upon this startling discovery, that the belief we Catholics have in authority is based upon an act of private judgment. How on earth could they ever suppose we taught otherwise? I say nothing here of the grace of faith, which is the hidden work of God in our souls. But how could the conscious process by which we arrive at any form of the truth begin without an act of private judgment? I may, indeed, overcome by a kind of emotional crisis, surrender myself unreflectively to an influence imaginatively experienced, but that is not Catholicism. It is Protestantism. It is conversion in its crudest form. If I employ my reason at all, if I employ my reason only so far as to say, the Church says this, and the Church is infallible, therefore this must be true, even so I'm using private judgment. It is my own reason which draws its conclusions from the syllogism. Reject private judgment. Of course Catholics have never rejected private judgment. They only profess to delimit the spheres in which private judgment and authority have their respective parts to play. Is it really so difficult to see that a revealed religion demands, from its very nature, a place for private judgment and a place for authority? A place for private judgment, in determining that the revelation itself comes from God, in discovering the medium through which that revelation comes to us, and the rule of faith by which we are enabled to determine what is, and what is not, revealed. A place for authority to step in, when these preliminary investigations are over, and say, now, be careful, for you are out of your depth here. How many persons subsist in the unity of the divine nature? What value and what power underlies the mystery of sacramental worship? How divine grace acts upon the human will? These and a hundred other questions are questions which your human reason cannot investigate for itself, and upon which it can pronounce no sentence, since it moves in the natural, not in the supernatural order. At this point, then, you must begin to believe but hearsay. From this point onwards you must ask, not to be convinced, but to be taught, is it really so illogical in us to fix the point at which our private judgment is no longer of any service? Are we really more inconsistent than the bather steps out cautiously through the shallow water and then, when it is breast high, spreads out his hands to swim? But there is a subtle and a more telling variation of the same argument. The strength of a chain, we are reminded, is that of its weakest link. We Catholics profess to establish the truths of religion by a chain of argument. This chain, then, is no stronger than the weakest link in it. How is it that we profess to hold with absolute certitude the revealed truths of our religion? Reasonable enough to say that, if your Church is infallible, the doctrines which she preaches are evidently true, and capable of producing absolute certitude in the mind. But the infallibility of your Church is not a self-evident axiom. It is a proposition which you have proved, and proved it by an appeal to ordinary human reason. Is it not clear, then, that in the last resort every statement which your Church makes rests upon the validity of the arguments by which, in the first instance, you proved your Church infallible? Now, these arguments, based as they are upon human reason, do not convey absolute certitude to the mind. They may be, in your view, overwhelmingly probable, nay, they may be certain with all human certainty, But human certainty is not absolute certainty. There is always a possible margin of error. You cannot prove the existence of God, the authority of Christ, or His commission to His church, beyond all possibility of doubt. How then can you suppose that you have proved beyond all possibility of doubt the statements which you receive on the Church's authority? To escape this dilemma, Catholic apologists have frequently used a metaphor which seems to me, I confess, singularly unfortunate. They tell us that the motives of credibility by which we establish the divine origin of the Church and her teaching office are like the scaffolding which is put up while a building is being erected. Once the building operations are complete, the scaffolding is unnecessary. It has served its turn, and we pay it no further attention. Now, theologically speaking, that metaphor will pass well enough. They mean that the true motive of our belief, seen on its supernatural side, is the infallible veracity of God in His revelation. But for purposes of apologetic, we shall employ such a metaphor in vain. Our critics will not be slow to point out that we erect a building inside the scaffolding, not on the top of the scaffolding, and if we did erect a building on the top of our scaffolding, we could not take the scaffolding away without letting the building fall to the ground. Our own parable has been turned against us. It will be better to avoid the metaphor, and to keep in mind the distinction just mentioned. The motives of credibility, satisfying his intellect, bring the inquirer up to the point of making the act of faith. That act recognizes God's authority in the Church's teaching, and the absolute nature of His authority does make all the difference to the kind of certitude with which, thenceforward, he holds the truths of Catholic doctrine. But this is inherent in the act of faith, not in the chain of proof by which the Catholic claim is established. Having made the act of faith, he cannot produce more or better arguments to convince his neighbor than he could have produced before. Apologetically, then, revealed truths have no higher certitude than the arguments by which the fact of revelation is established. The revealed proposition that there are three persons in the Blessed Trinity is not, apologetically, more certain than the statement established in the first instance by private judgment that our Lord left the charisma of infallibility to His Church. The Catholic claim does not profess to be based on a mathematical certainty. The proposition, things which are equal to the same thing, are equal to one another, is evident in the sense that the contrary proposition is unthinkable. The proposition, Jesus of Nazareth suffered under Pontius Pilate, is not evident in that sense. The contrary proposition, in this case, does not defy our thought. In historical statements, and every revealed religion must depend, in the last resort, upon an historical statement, the highest kind of certainty you could attain is that which excludes reasonable doubt. That is the kind of proof which Catholicism claims for those preliminary considerations which it calls the motives of credibility, and consequently no point of Catholic doctrine can claim anything better than this historical kind of proof. The absolute certainty with which we believe the teaching of the Church comes to us from the supernatural grace of faith, which transforms our reasoned conviction into a higher quality. The water, as at Cana, is turned into wine. But for apologetic purposes, a reasoned conviction is all we can offer to our neighbors, and it is this reasoned conviction which the present thesis attempts to maintain. It will be observed that those Platonic admirers of the Catholic system whom I referred to in the last chapter, the people, wish they were Catholics, without having in fact any intention of becoming Catholics, are usually guilty of an utter misconception. They imagine that the Catholic Church is asking them to make a leap in the dark, and they feel, sometimes, as if they would like to make that leap, or rather, to have made it, because it would save them the trouble of any intellectual effort. If only they could be trepanned into the Church, if only they could be shanghaied on board the Ark of Peter, the passage would quite possibly, they feel, be a pleasant one. But the Church is not asking them to take any such sudden leap, will not allow them, in fact, to assume rights of membership until they have been through a course of intellectual instruction. It is their duty to satisfy their own minds, proportionately to their general level of mental culture, about God's existence, the authority of Christ, etc., before they can expect the grace of faith to come to them. A false statement of Catholic belief may, of course, be made without entering into apologetic considerations at all. The question, "What do you Catholics teach?" may be interpreted as a demand, inspired by enlightened curiosity, to have the revealed doctrines which we inculcate set forth in an orderly scheme. But the reader of such a document, unless he is himself a Catholic or at least a catechumen, holds these doctrines at arm's length as he considers them, regards them merely as an exposé of his neighbor's religious psychology. They have not, for him, the interest of an appeal or a challenge. I'm fully conscious how difficult it is for anyone to make such an appeal, such a challenge successfully, fully conscious that my own qualifications for the task are at best those of an amateur, not those of a specialist. But I'm writing in the hope, not merely of informing the reader, but of persuading him, or at least of contributing to that end. Consequently, I must take nothing for granted. I must adopt for my model the author whom Horace condemned for beginning his Epic of Troy with the story of Lettisac. I must assume that the reader has an open mind even on the question whether God exists or number. I'm the more encouraged to take this course by the fact that in our day many intelligent people profess themselves theists, hold their beliefs precariously and unreflectively, without troubling to inquire what they involve, nay, that Christians themselves, from a lack of systematic instruction, often misconceive the nature of the God whom their own theology preaches, and are halfway towards pantheism without knowing it. It will do no harm to test each link in the chain of Christian apologetic, be the hand that wields the hammer never so unworkmanlike. Or the God hides himself. Philosophers have continually been exercised by the question whether a knowledge of God is a direct or a derived knowledge, whether the idea of God is in some way native to the mind, or whether we arrive at it through our knowledge of other things, his creatures. The mystical temperament, which has a strong influence on the outlook of Protestant theologians, is naturally disposed to claim, if the claim can in any way be justified, that our knowledge of God is direct. For it is the instinct of the mystic to reject as far as possible all interference, all mediation, between God and the soul. The simplest, the most plausible of all these theories is traditionalism. As a matter of observation, it is plainly true that the origin from which your knowledge of God is derived, or mine, is the assurance given to us in infancy by our mothers or those who are responsible for our education. What if this should be not only the origin, but the justification of the concept? Adam, we must suppose, had in some way an experimental knowledge of God's existence. Did not he, in the strength of that knowledge, make theists of his sons, and they of theirs, and so on down the whole series of history, until at last the information came to our mothers, and through them to us? The evidence we have, in that case, for the existence of God is a tradition, perpetuated through the long course of human history, and resting in the last resort on the testimony of men had walked with God, had first-hand knowledge of the facts. Or, failing that, there is a possible refuge in fideism. After all, religion is concerned with the supernatural order, which altogether transcends ours. Why should there not be a special supernatural revelation to man, which enables him to apprehend the existence of God, made, if you will, before he is yet old enough to be conscious of the fact? Is it not, perhaps, the best account we can give of this persistent human belief in a deity, to suppose that there is a special faculty implanted in all of us at birth, but obscured in some of us by faults of training or of character, which apprehends God by a simple act, unintellectual because it is supra-intellectual? One philosopher at least, Descartes, would go further than this, and claim that for this purpose no supernatural revelation was needed. The thinking mind, according to his analysis, was primarily conscious of two clear and distinct ideas, itself and God. Outward things, the phenomena of sense, were only mirrored for it through the medium of its own consciousness, but the two facts of its own existence and God's were guaranteed to it antecedently to any reasoning whatsoever. At the very basis of all our thought lay the perception of a God was responsible for implanting in us the ideas with which our thought is concerned. His non-existence was worse than unthinkable. It would destroy the very possibility of all knowledge. You must believe in God, in order to believe in anything at all. This was at the dawn of idealism, but a theory not altogether dissimilar had found patronage even in the scholastic age. I mean the ontological proof, which is usually connected with the name of Saint Anselm. The idea of God was necessarily one of supreme perfection. It was impossible to associate the notion of any fault or a defect with the idea of God. But the notion of non-existence is the notion of a fault or defect indeed, a very considerable one. Therefore it is impossible to associate the notion of non-existence with the idea of God. Therefore it is unthinkable that God should not exist. Therefore God exists. This attempt to prove the existence of God, or to declare the proof of it unnecessary, without reference to the effects of his power which we experience in his visible creation, is a permanent temptation to the human mind. Intellects as far removed from one another as those of Anselm, Descartes, and Ibanez have undertaken it, and it is probable that they will never lack successors. Protestant thought, in our day, is much wedded not to these, but to similar speculations. Thus, you will seldom read any piece of non-Catholic apologetic without coming across some reference to man's sense of his need for God, or man's notion of holiness, a notion which can only be perfectly realized in God. The implication of all such language is that it is possible to argue directly from the existence of concepts in our own mind to the existence of real objects to which those concepts correspond. The Catholic Church discountenances all such methods of approach to the subject. Some of them, at the Vatican Council, she has actually condemned. She discountenances them, at least, if and in so far as they claim to be the sole or the main argument for the existence of God. The main, if not the sole, argument for the existence of God, so she holds, and has always held, is the argument which proves the unseen from the seen, the existence of the Creator from his visible effects in creation. All these efforts at the solution of the problem really depend for their plausibility on a postulate, which we do not grant, namely, that it would have been impossible for the human race to infer God's existence from his creatures. If this were true, then it might be argued that the notion of God must be an idea directly communicated to our minds. Such an argument is perfectly valid, if applied to our sense of right and wrong. It must be native to the mind, because there is nothing outside ourselves which could possibly have suggested such a notion to us. But this is a simple idea, directly entertained, whereas the idea of God is a composite idea, and the attributes which we associate with it, power, wisdom, etc., are derived from our own experience. If there had been no God, said Napoleon, it would have been necessary to invent him. At least, we may say it would have been possible to invent him. Thus the fact that the idea of God is conceived by our minds does not necessarily mean that it is inborn in us, or that it is directly communicated to us by some supernatural light. This supposition is an unnecessary one. And now, what is it to say for itself? If it were true, as Descartes held, that the idea of God was a clear and distinct idea, like that of our own existence, why is it that there are so few fools in the world doubt their own existence? So many say, there is no God. If the existence of God was one of the first principles of all our mental process, then the contrary idea, that there is no God, should be unthinkable. But is it unthinkable? People think it every day. But at least, Saint Anselm would retort, it is impossible to think of an imperfect God, and therefore it is impossible to think of a non-existent God, to which the atheist replies with some justice that, since God does not exist, it is not necessary to think about him at all. You cannot argue from the ideal to the real order of things. The apologist is on safer ground if he leaves the arena of philosophy altogether, and maintains that the notion of God, so far from being innate in our minds, is something supernaturally implanted in them by a kind of direct revelation. That some such revelation was made to our first parents, we have no ground for disputing, but it would need a robust faith in us to accept so momentous a doctrine on the remote authority of our first parents, even if popular science would give us leave to suppose that we had any. Can we really be certain that in so many centuries of transmission the revelation has remained intact, that the tale has not lost in the telling? On the other hand, Fidism would have us believe that such a direct revelation is made not once for all to the human race, but to each individual soul. Is it